Support for WPR comes from Stafford Rosenbaum, a Wisconsin-based law firm celebrating 145 years of commitment to practical legal solutions in areas such as family law and estate planning. StaffordLaw.com.
Support for WPR comes from Isthmus Partners, an asset management firm providing comprehensive financial planning and tailored investment solutions for long-term growth and capital preservation. More at IsthmusPartnersLLC.com.
You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Monday, March the 12th. And we are very happy to have with us this hour Ralph Nader. You know Ralph Nader, former presidential candidate, consumer advocate, civic activist. We will be talking with him about his brand new book, The 17 Traditions. The 17 traditions that he absorbed from his parents, his family, his community, that helped shape him into who he is today. And we'll talk about this more personal side of Ralph Nader this hour. We won't concentrate on his views on current political issues, but we welcome your participation at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890. Ralph Nader, recently named by The Atlantic as one of the 100 most influential figures in American history, only one of four living people to be honored, the son of immigrants from Lebanon, he has launched two major presidential campaigns, founded or organized more than 100 civic organizations, and he is the author of The 17 Traditions, a book being released prior to a film also to be released based on Ralph Nader's life. It's entitled An Unreasonable Man, and it will be opening next week in Madison. Ralph Nader, good morning.
Morning to you, Joy.
Thanks a lot for being with us.
You're welcome.
I really enjoyed reading your book. You know, in some ways, it reminded me of parts of it anyway, of my growing up and my childhood and my hometown and things my parents told me. Is this a time, though, that's I don't know, long forgotten, a different time?
Well, it's an attempt to, it was really a love story for my mother and dad, and all they went through during the Depression, World War II, and even in the 20s, when in the 10s, my mother and father came here from Lebanon when they were 19, and so they had a new culture, a new language, and all their children were born in Connecticut, and they developed a tradition of reciprocity, learning from their children and, of course, teaching them with their judgment and wisdom. And in that sense, the book is full of stories that will resonate today with families, because the challenges of raising children, however different the technology is from generation to generation, are very much the same. Trying to get them to eat what's good for them, respect their parents, do their chores, apply their studies, go out in the community and help improve the community, learn simple enjoyments, not just always commercial entertainment. There's a lot of lessons here for families raising children today, especially moms and dads who have to commute and be distant from their children and who feel that so many things around them are out of their control, including their children. Mm-hmm. So I thought this would be a timely book. It is a good Mother's Day and Father's Day book, but I thought it would encourage other families to put down their own traditions and over their three or four generations so they can pass this wisdom, insight, and experience to their children and grandchildren who often are spending too much time just watching screens, you know, TV and computer and video games and not socializing enough.
Yeah, tell us about the town you grew up in, Winsted, Connecticut.
Yes. That's a small factory town in northwest Connecticut in the beautiful Litchfield Hills, crossed by two rivers, one called the Mad River and the other the Still River. And the Mad River was well named because it overflowed periodically and destroyed the main street, including my dad's restaurant, twice in 30 years. And my memory of the town is that it was very contentious. It was half Republican, half Democrat, half Yankee fan, half Red Sox fan. Had about 20 bars. I think it had more bars per square yard than any town east of the Pecos. And it had a town meeting form of government. So the people were the legislature, in effect. And when they went to the town meeting, there was spirited talk and argument and proposals and so forth. So being a multi-ethnic town as well, it was the kind of community to grow up in that made you adjust to a lot of stimuli. That's why the first tradition in the book, Joy, which is a tradition of learning to listen. My mother was big on that. She said if you talked all the time and didn't listen, what were you going to learn? And that helped the children, two girls, two boys, throughout their lives.
Yeah. I like that story when you were, I think, traveling with her in an airplane, and the person behind you was just yakking it up the entire time, and then she said, well, he didn't learn very much this trip, did he?
That was exactly her. Yeah. Another thing she was keen on, and along with my dad, is never prefer one child over another because of the serious scarring of the disfavored child, often for a lifetime. And so they were very even, Stephen, that way. And they had their arguments and disagreements, but never in front of us. They thought, A, we couldn't understand what they were disagreeing over, and B, that we would disrespect them. So they ironed out their differences in private. And they were all pretty appalled when they'd see parents in a rage against one another in front of sort of stunned children. They never thought that was a good way to raise children.
Yeah. Well, I do want to touch on a lot of these, if not all of these 17 traditions. You talked about the tradition of listening that your mother advocated. The tradition of the family table. What did you always have? The sit-down meal?
The sit-down meal where there was no TV and radio. Mm-hmm. There was a talk. My parents would either describe a historical saga. There's a tradition of history in the book. Or they would challenge us with something going on in the town, country, and world and ask us for our response and our opinion. And one thing that helped this dinner table conversation was that right from the beginning, my mother told us as young children, you're too young to decide what you're going to eat. You don't know what's good for you. And your parents are going to eat what you eat, and you're going to eat what we eat. No double standard. So there was very little fidgeting at the table over not wanting to eat, except for one memorable occasion when I was between 7 and 8, I think. Mm-hmm. I rebelled one day at celery, carrots, and I guess it was broccoli that was put on the table as an appetizer. And I don't want to eat this. I don't like this. My mother would say, this is good for you, Ralph. You should eat it. No, I don't want to. I don't like. And so she leaned down at me with her wonderful smile and said, Ralph, you keep saying, I don't like, I don't want. Who's I? And I'd say, I? It's me, Mother. It's Ralph. And no. Who's I? Is it your liver, your kidneys, your lung, your heart, your brain? Who's I? And I was totally flummoxed by this point. And she then said, I think I know who I is, Ralph. I is your tongue, and you're turning your tongue against your brain. This is good for you. Eat up. Well, I never forgot that. It's those little stories in the book. When I came home one day at age 10 from school, my father said, well, Ralph, what'd you learn today in school? Did you learn to believe or did you learn to think? Never forgot that. Backyard, springtime, whole family there, beautiful sunshine. Mother says, how much are a dozen eggs to us? How much is a loaf of bread? How much is a bushel of apples? How much is a pound of butter? We knew all the answers because we were a restaurant family. My father had a sprawling restaurant on Main Street opposite all the textile companies, factories. We wondered why she was asking those questions. And then she turned around and looked up, and she said, what's the price of that sunshine? Isn't that breeze, that cool breeze, nice? How much does that cost? What about those beautiful songs the blue jays and robins are singing to us now? And how about that apple tree on our yard? Well, she was basically saying that nature was extremely important and you can't put a price on it, but it's still very, very valuable. And again, that was the source of my interest in the environment.
Oh, yeah. You talk about how that you also could, you know, whatever, walk to this lake in your town to swim. Talked about the garden that you had in the backyard, and the fruit trees. And that I had a laugh about that one, too, because the apple trees sounded a lot like the apple trees in my backyard.
Well, that's what's good about this book, I think. It does resonate and evoke memories of people and their families. In fact, we want to try to help establish a tradition of family traditions where millions of families start putting down systematically their insights, wisdom, and experience over three or four generations before it's too late for great-grandparents or grandparents, and pass it on to children who really need that kind of connectedness. They really need it. And fortunately, there are video cameras and audio recorders, and it's very easy today to do that if you don't want to laboriously write them down. So we have a website called 17 Traditions, the word, 17traditions.com, inviting people to send us a choice tradition or two just to get them going on strengthening the family against all the external assaults on it, commercial assaults, long commutes, long absences, direct marketing to children of things that aren't good for them by companies, even at an age of 3 or 4 years old, junk food, junk drink, violent programming. We've got to strengthen the family, which will lead to better neighborhoods and communities.
Yeah. We're talking with Ralph Nader. We're talking about his new book, The 17 Traditions. These are 17 key traditions that he learned from his parents and his siblings and his community that helped shape his life, and he believes helped shape the society. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. We welcome your thoughts and questions for Ralph Nader, and maybe you have some thoughts about traditions in your own family and ideas to strengthen the family in this day and age. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 22 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Monday, March the 12th. Ben Marins is with you this afternoon between 4 and 6. It's At Issue with Ben Marins. After 5, the Great Decisions series continues. Today, Ben and his guest will discuss the politics, the economy, and the future of South Africa. We're talking with Ralph Nader about the 17 traditions that he describes in his new book, where he talks about his boyhood and his parents and what they taught him. And we welcome your questions and thoughts for him. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Ralph Nader, talking about the tradition of the family table and the tradition of health. Somewhere in there, I read that your mother never served you a hot dog when you were growing up.
That's right. I mean, because she didn't know it was in it.
Yeah.
And she was skeptical. Later on, when I worked for the Meat Inspection Act in the late 60s in Congress, we found out more what was in hot dogs, and it was a lot of fat and filler and not stuff you really want to feed your child, no matter how delicious it may be with mustard. But one of the things that was interesting about the hometown that we grew up in was, as I said, my father had a restaurant where it was said, for a nickel, you got a cup of coffee in Nader's restaurant and 10 minutes of politics. Well, it was not just his politics. He encouraged all kinds of people to come in the sprawling big restaurant and really talk it up. And freedom of speech on steroids, so to speak.
Yeah.
And I grew up in that. One of our chores was helping out in the restaurant. Another was doing the Victory Garden in World War II. There was rationing in World War II, rationing of gasoline, heating oil, food products. And so Franklin Delano Roosevelt urged all Americans, if they could, to start Victory Gardens in their backyard. And so we had a Victory Garden. And out of that came not only a sense of growing your own food, and it would be called organic now, but a sense of frugality and thrift. My father would save aluminum foil and roll it up in an ever bigger ball and string, And today that's called recycling. So you can see the origins of what I have been doing in the environmental area. It really comes back to those early experiences.
Yeah. Talk about, there was a story that you had in here about your dad talking to a doctor, I believe, at his restaurant. Do you recall that? It was in the lessons from, or the tradition of charity.
Yes. Yeah. Well, a doctor friend, he would come to the restaurant every day to have a cup of coffee. And one day he came in and he said to my father at the counter, "Why are the auto workers' wages so high?" And my father said, so they can afford to pay your bills. Why do you charge so much?" And the doctor says, "Because we often treat poor people free." And then my father, smiling, said, "Well, in that case, since we give free coffee to poor people here, your coffee, which was then 10 cents, today is $1. Thank you very much." So, in other words, the lesson here is Dad didn't think that his charitable activities were something to be pawned off on the backs of his other customers.
Yeah.
And I've never forgot that. I actually observed that exchange. It was right after World War II when the United Auto Workers were engaged in bargaining with the auto companies.
Yeah, and your dad, he seemed like a great guy, quite a character. I loved his dinner table conversation starters to you kids. I mean, it was really complex world politics stuff.
He never let us run away from an argument. No, never. He had some wonderful ways of saying things. Like one day I said to him, "Dad, I did my best." And he said, "Ralph, never say you did your best, because then you won't do any better." Mm. So he had this wonderful pithiness to his statements.
Yeah. Let me bring in a caller, Colleen in Janesville. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Good morning. Mr. Nader, I just was wondering, does your book address, for those of us who are trying to raise children in this world now, how we can do this sort of, you know, traditional thing with our kids, too? It's hard, though, when the rest of the world or community isn't on the same page, and it's a tough battle when you're trying to do that and the influences from the outside are on your kids. You know, do you address that at all, what we can do about, you know, just sticking to our guns and doing this for our children?
Yes, I do. First, my mother would always say, the earlier you get to a child, the more likely the child be protected from bad influences, whether it's just personal addictions or falling in with the wrong friends and the wrong crowd. And she would always interview our friends, and there were some that she just said, you cannot go with them. When she approved of our friends, she'd invite them for dessert or for breakfast, and she'd be very, very friendly with them, and that made us feel very good, because she knew the peer group could be very bad competition for her attempts to raise good children. And third, she gave us solitude by ourselves, so we could dream and wonder, and not over, today would be called over-scheduling the child, so that we could play with our building blocks or our stamp collection, gaze at the stars, follow the butterflies. There's a tradition of solitude in the book that's very important. And above all, she and Dad instilled in us the tradition of independent thinking. And I'll give you an example, which I'm sure you'll resonate with. One day in the third grade, I came home half whining, half crying. She said, "What's wrong, Ralph?" I said, "The boys are wearing long pants, and I want to wear long pants. I don't like short pants." And she said, "What's wrong with short pants?" "Well, it's cold in the winter, and if I fell, I'll scrape my knee if I have short pants." And that didn't work with her, so I tried my trump card. I straightened up, and I said, "Mother, their mothers let them wear long pants." And she looked at me and smiled and said, "Well, they have their mothers, and you have yours." And then she had a trump line. She said, "Ralph, why are you so worried about being a little different?" That had a tremendous impact on me, and not being pressured to conform and to conform. It's that conformity among young children and preteens and teenagers that often is so destructive. It destroys independent thinking. She used to say, "Turn your back on the pack. Be yourself." And this book is full of stories that respond to the caller's question.
1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Our numbers, if you would like to join in our conversation this hour with Ralph Nader, author of many, many different books, but we are talking about his latest, The 17 Traditions, where he looks back at his childhood and the 17 key traditions that he absorbed from his parents. Traditions such as the tradition of listening, charity, civics, work, patriotism, simple enjoyment. We welcome your questions for him. And Ralph Nader, I knew this was going to happen. We're getting a bunch of people who want to call to talk about things like, are you going to run for president? You want to get that out of the way? Are you going to run for president?
Too early to say.
Yeah.
The important thing now is I'm on a book tour for this mm-hmm. book, because I really think families have got to become more self-conscious. They have got to sort of cut down on the huge intrusions on the family and nurture those children and become much more self-conscious and pass the wisdom of the generations within their family and extended family onto their children. You know, the tradition of civics in our family was observing my mother and father go around improving the community, helping to modernize the hospital, helping to build a dry dam to prevent the Mad River from destroying the main street. She did that by meeting the grandfather of the present president, the Senator Prescott Bush, when he came to town on a campaign. And she went up, shook his hand, and said, "We've got to have a dry dam, Senator Bush. Too much loss of life, too much loss of property. We can't have it again with this Mad River overflowing during heavy rains or a hurricane." And he smiled and was going on to the next person to shake hands the way politicians do, and she wouldn't let go of his hand. And there were about 10 people watching this awkward situation, and until he basically said, "Mrs. Nader, I'll get you a dry dam." And he got the Corps of Engineers to build the dry dam, and we've never had a flood since 1955, Hurricane Diane. And that lesson to her was, to us rather, was when you want to get an answer from a politician, and you're shaking hands, don't let go.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you see, watching this as children, they would take us to the town meeting. They would take us to the county courthouse. They take us to public gatherings. And because we learned to listen, we were observing. We absorbed it. We didn't fidget and try to make the world center around ourselves the way some children do.
Yeah. Your mother came up in a conversation that I had earlier this morning on a different topic, but a topic that I know is important to you. It was the library books and McDonald's offering to give kids free hamburgers if they returned books to the library, and your mother thought that that was just wrong-headed, that you don't need, a child shouldn't be rewarded for doing what that child should do anyway.
Exactly. She said that was like a bribe for what the child should do as a matter of honesty, and she won. She won that.
Yeah.
The children should return those books as a matter of honesty and duty and respect for the library, not because they get a hamburger down the street at McDonald's. And that, again, you see, was the civic value of honesty in a community clashing with the commercial value of a McDonald's hamburger to induce good behavior. And again, you see the seeds of the way the children developed came from little episodes like that. My brother started the community college here in Winston, the smallest town in America at the time to have a community college. And that came out of robust discussions in the restaurant with the townspeople. And he formed a core of townspeople, and they pulled it off. And with all the factories leaving Winsted, like they left a lot of New England towns, either going south for cheap labor or being closed down by acquisitions from big companies in New York, that community college helped save the town.
Yeah. Well, the reason that story came up is the issue I was talking about was Pizza Hut has a program where it will reward kids if they read a certain number of books, and it's a program that some public schools participate in. They'll get a free pizza coupon if they read so many books. And we talked with a guest who said that this is got to go. This kind of program shouldn't be in our schools. And not only does it promote the wrong idea, eat pizzas, and it doesn't necessarily improve reading, it undermines parents. And I wonder if you would agree with that.
No, exactly. Mm-hmm. None of that commercializes incentives that should be nurtured apart from any kind of commercial reward. There's actually a growing effort in this country to pay students for getting good grades in high school, which I think is terrible. I mean, it does undermine the family institution, and it undermines the principles of doing the right thing because it's the right thing to do, not because somebody pays you or somebody gives you a pizza. What happens if somebody doesn't give you a pizza? I mean, quite apart from what's on the pizza, huh? But no, this is a definition in this book, 17 Traditions, of family values that are inextricable from civic values, seamless. Improving the community was part of family values. Business practices in the restaurant, part of family values. My father routinely fed poor people in the terrible depression who came in hungry. Didn't make a big deal out of it. That was a family restaurant. That was a family value. Upstairs in his building, there was a dentist who was drafted in World War II. He came down to say goodbye. He's worried about what would happen. Would the space be available? And my father said, Harry, his name was Harry Garbus. He said, Harry, don't you worry at all. I'm not going to rent that space as long as you're in the Army. When you get out of the Army, come by. We'll have a cup of coffee, and I'll give you the keys. You go up, restart your practice. He could have rented that space in a minute in World War II, but that was family values. So family values, civic values, business values, we grew up not making distinctions between those.
Mm-hmm. What about the tradition of patriotism? What did your parents teach you about that?
That was counterintuitive. That was not flag-waving. That was improving the country. Patriotism, you know, literally means, you know, love of country, which to them meant love of people. And they did not brook the rah-rah. One time some factory workers came over who knew Dad for years, and they'd always kid with him. And he would always be critical of things in the government or town, and they'd say, Nader, you know, just love it or leave it. Why don't you go back where you came from? And he said, you know, when I sailed past the Statue of Liberty in 1912, my friends, I took it seriously. Don't you? And then he turned the tables on him. He said, do you know the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag? And he said, darn right. We learned it in the first grade. He said, why don't you tell me the last few words? And there would be a pause because the last few words were, with liberty and justice for all. So he'd make him say that, and then he'd say, remember, it's liberty and justice for all, not for some, not for a few. So he didn't brook this rah-rah. To him, it was doing, not just rah-rah. Are you improving your community? Are you spending time from your routine in helping other Americans? And so that was a tradition of patriotism that we grew up in.
We will go next to Rich in Rhinelander. Hi, Rich. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. I certainly have no problem hearing the son of a restaurateur talk about turning the tables. And, Mr. Nader, I like you and I respect you, and I'll buy your book for sure, but not online or at a big box store. I'll go to a small bookstore in Madison, a room of one's own, a feminist bookstore, in order to buy it. But one of the traditions in our family is you fight with your family, that is, within your family, and you fight against the forces without your family, that is, outside your family, in order to preserve the traditions. And I know this is going to seem like sort of an attack on you, but I don't mean it to be. I'm one of those Americans who really does see a dime's worth of difference between having a George W. Bush in the presidency and having someone like an Al Gore or even a John Kerry in the presidency. And I certainly supported you in the early stages of your candidacies. I really think that it's time for you to fight within those parameters of a family of people who are somewhat concerned about the same values that you say you share, and fight very hard, maybe even becoming Secretary of Health or something like that, but not to divert even a single vote away from the possibility of another Republican taking the White House. I have nothing against Republicans, but I do have a great deal against their current policies, Mr. Nader.
Well, you know, I had that attitude for 20 years, you know, trying to work with the Democrats, and as the old Democrats faded out, retired, great Democrats like Senator Proxmire, Senator Gaylord Nelson from Wisconsin, the new Democrats were all about money, raising money to try to compete with the Republicans and turn your back on old Democratic policies like living wage and President Truman's desire for universal health care and more fair taxation. And after 20 years, I realized that the doors were slamming on citizen groups in Washington. They couldn't get hearings. They couldn't get agencies like the Food and Drug Administration or the Auto Safety Agency to respond to their petitions or even give them a hearing. And that was true under Clinton and Gore, very much. Both parties were just dialing for the same dollars. So you're basically shut out. You want to try to improve your country. You want to try to help other civic groups in Washington that have millions of members from around the country, environmental, consumer, worker rights groups, prison reform groups, et cetera. And the door keeps slamming shut. So then you say to yourself, well, you know, I think I'll run for president and put on the table in front of the voters these issues that the Democrats should have picked up but didn't. The old Democrats would have picked up and landslided the Republicans, including this bumbling governor from Texas in 2000. Well, they didn't do that in 2000. You'll recognize the difference between Gore now, who's liberated, and talking about global warming. Well, he didn't do that when he was vice president. He didn't make the environment a big issue in his campaign. He toned all these issues down that might be critical of corporations and their executives who are contributing to the Democratic Party. So put yourself in our shoes. We have over 30 issues that we are pushing forward in Washington. Efficient use of tax dollars, consumer protection of bank depositors, insurance policyholders, et cetera, food safety, and so on. And they weren't going anywhere. Now, I will grant you the Democrats are better on Social Security, they're better on Medicare, they're better on a number of civil liberties and civil rights, but overall they have joined the Republicans with commercializing our election and letting corporations control one department and agency after another, including the bloated, wasteful military budget that Senator Proxmire used to go after so dutifully. So that's the story from this side. The Democrats have become very good at electing very bad Republicans.
We're talking with Ralph Nader. He is, as you know, a former presidential candidate, had launched two major presidential campaigns. Says hasn't decided yet, too early to say if he will run again. He was recently named by The Atlantic as one of the 100 most influential figures in American history, one of only four living people to be honored. He is the son of immigrants from Lebanon. He has organized or founded more than 100 civic organizations. He is the author of many books, including his latest, which we are focusing on this hour. It's called The 17 Traditions. The 17 Traditions that Ralph Nader absorbed from his parents, his upbringing, that made him who he is today. 1-800-642-1234, toll free from anywhere if you would like to talk with Ralph Nader. And we're trying to concentrate on these traditions and how family values and how to strengthen the family today, more so than current political issues. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 8:45 on this Monday, March the 12th. Coming up after 9, Kathleen Dunn, going to be on tape today. her son broke his wrist, and she has to attend to him and take him to the doctor, and we wish him well, Andrew and Kathleen for that matter. So instead of her regularly scheduled program, we will hear Kathleen talking with Rolling Stone magazine writer Jonathan Cott about his book, On the Sea of Memory, A Journey from Forgetting to Remembering. That's coming up after 9 o'clock. We're talking to Ralph Nader this hour. He's looking back on his childhood and the 17 key traditions that he absorbed from his parents that he writes about in the new book, The 17 Traditions, which, by the way, is being released in tandem with the release of a new feature film about Mr. Nader. That movie is called An Unreasonable Man, and it'll be opening in Madison, I know, on March 23rd at the Orpheum Theater. It says here, Ralph Nader, that you're often asked, you know, what forces shaped you, and you would say, I had a lucky choice of parents. And this book gives you more time to delve into that answer.
Yeah.
Yeah, but not everybody has that lucky choice of parents, do they?
No, they don't. Mm. But the key is self-confidence. I know a lot of single moms with more than one job who are raising great kids under tremendous pressure, and that the theme that unifies all of them is that they have confidence in their own judgment. They are not afraid of their children. My mother always would say to young parents, the moment you indicate you're afraid of your child, afraid to discipline, afraid to control their misbehavior, it's only going to get worse for you. The tradition of discipline in this book, 17 Traditions, Joy, was very telling in that respect. My parents did not believe in corporal punishment. Not only were they appalled when they'd see parents in fits of rage slam their three-year-old in the wall, but they thought that corporal punishment reflected a failure on the part of the parents to begin with, that they had to go to that final resort. So they started disciplining us when we misbehaved with proverbs. They wouldn't say, stop it, cut it out, don't do this, do that. They would float just the right Arabic proverb. Arabic was very rich mm-hmm. in proverbs coming from the oral tradition. I mean, when they grew up in Lebanon as youngsters, there was no electricity in their area. So they had to memorize and inherit an oral tradition of history and culture and proverbs. And so the proverbs had a very calming effect on us. And obviously they had stood the test of centuries, so they were very well honed. And when that didn't work, they would say, just stand in the corner near the sewing machine, turn around, look at the wall, and contemplate your misbehavior, and that you're not going to do it again. So that was the tradition of discipline. And it's so wonderful to see parents who do not resort to physical violence against their children. But early on, as my mother said, if you reach the child early on, you'll have much less difficulty later on.
Yeah. Tony in Appleton is with us now. Hi, Tony.
Good morning, Joy, and thank you. Mm-hmm. Mr. Nader, it's an honor.
Thank you, sir.
If I may, just 10 seconds. I'm in agreement with you politically. I am a Venice Democrat supporter, but they have sold out. I'm sorry. But on to my question. I am a school teacher, or at least I was, and one of the most depressing things I had to deal with, and this is high school, was an attitude that came from students that basically said, what I do in school is not important. I don't get paid for it. It's just I'm just here. And what's really important is when I get a job or that I go to my job and then I work and do this and my studies are unimportant. And what I'd like you to do is if I could hear some background from you, some wisdom, some comment, I would appreciate it. And if you don't mind, I'm just going to hang up and listen to you on the radio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. Well, a lot of the quality of education is the involvement of the parents. That's become a cliche now, of course. But I don't just mean PTA. When my father asked me whether I learned how to believe or think, I went back to school and I was very alert year after year with the teachers whether they were telling us what to believe or stimulating us to think. And I remember in the fifth grade, my teacher, Miss Thompson, came in one day and wrote on the blackboard before the class started the following words, lost, 60 seconds. Don't bother looking for it because you'll never find it again. And that meant to us, don't delay. Do things on time. I never forgot that. In fact, when I look back and try to remember what happened in the fifth grade, that was right up at the top of the list. It wasn't even part of the course. So my family helped increase the quality of education in my school hours. And so it isn't just PTA. We had a lot of books at home. My father and mother were never impressed by how fast and how many books we read. It's what we got out of the books. And my father once said to us, you know, a book is the most fantastic bargain. The author spends months or years writing it, and you can derive the benefit from it in just a few hours. What a great bargain. So it's that meant when we went to school and read books, we had that kind of background, that kind of context. So today, obviously, the usual explanation to your response is, hey, you're not going to get a good job unless you do good in school, go to college, maybe graduate school. There's a correlation between the years of education, your income for the rest of your life. But there are other qualities, as I've just discussed, that are very important. What we need most now in schools is civic education. That is, developing not just computer skills, but civic skills, how to practice democracy to solve problems with known solutions, both at the local, state, national, and world level, and how to develop that civic self-confidence from learning how to use the Free Information Act of the state of Wisconsin, for example, all the way to removing your susceptibility to discouragement after you lose a battle. And as my father would tell us, your best teacher is your last mistake.
Yeah. Carl in Chippewa Falls is with us now. Hi, Carl.
Hi. My question for Mr. Nader has nothing in regards to your book. I'm concerned on how you treat the soldiers returning from the war. If you had any advice for our government today?
Yeah, I think that the treatment of soldiers is obviously atrocious in some respects, mediocre in others, and in some respects very good. Walter Reed treated the soldiers very well in some respects, but when they moved from the military into the civilian area, the paperwork, the bureaucracy, the delay were intolerable. But it's interesting that the responsibility for this does not go up high in our government. It's not enough for George W. Bush, who had been told about these problems for years since the war started in Iraq, his war, his illegal war. He knew about this, and yet he just went on TV, and in his very, very clever speech-making, he looked out at the people and said about the Walter Reed exposés, especially in Building 18. He said, this is unacceptable to me, it's unacceptable to you, it's unacceptable to our country, and it's got to change. Well, that's not acceptable. That kind of evasive maneuver is not acceptable. As Harry Truman once said, the buck stops here at his desk. And I think the Veterans for Peace, the veterans from the Iraq War groups, all these veteran groups are mobilizing so that the adequate resources are shifted from the corruption and greed of the Halliburtons and other corporate contractors in Iraq to the care and nurturing of the wounded veterans and giving them adequate opportunity to make a living.
We go now to John in Kenosha. Hi, John.
Yes, hi. How are you?
Good. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Mr. Nader. Are you there?
Yes, sir.
I have a tremendous amount of respect for you, sir, and it's a true honor to speak with you. A quick question about the Israeli Lebanon conflict that just occurred just recently. Why does the United States government continue to support Israel in light of all of their UN violations and the atrocities that are going on towards the Palestinians? Why does the United States government continue to support this? It goes against all of our values, our democracy, the amount of the only way that these walls of occupation would survive is unless we continue to send billions of dollars worth of our money, diplomatic support, military support. Why do we do this?
Because there's a very strong organized lobby in this country to make it happen that way. You know, the pro-Israeli government lobby is organized as citizen action, and it's they're every right to do that. But there needs to be a broader national interest here. The majority of Israelis and Palestinians for years have come to the conclusion that a two-state solution, an independent, viable Palestinian state along with a secure Israel, is the only way out. The problem is the imbalance of power between the Palestinians and the enormous military, technological, and economic power of Israel with the U.S. government's backing makes it unlikely for such an agreement to be reached. And we have to recognize that that conflict is not just restricted to that area of the world. It's spreading into other areas and creating a lot of problems for us around the world. And I think Jimmy Carter's book, which has been much maligned unfairly, represents the best direction for a peace process between the two parties.
Talk a little bit about the tradition of history that you took a trip with your mother and your siblings to Lebanon, did you not?
Yes, as a young boy, actually before World War II, we took a steamship to Lebanon to spend time with my aunts and cousins and grandparents. And in that year, we were really steeped in history. We went to the Baalbek ruins, the Roman ruins in Baalbek. We went to many historical sites, and we got a lot of oral tradition in terms of the history and struggles in that area over the generations. And we marveled at how much people retained in their memory of those many years. So that was a very rich experience for us. We also picked up some Arabic.
Mm. One more call, John in Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I want to ask Mr. Nader, you know, this thing about family values, and then it's important to look after family values, the traditional family values. But how does this whole notion of gay marriages and now where same-sex people can actually adopt children, how does that fit into the tradition of family values? I'll take my answer on the radio. Thank you.
Well, the family values we were raised in were not subservient values. They were not ideologically militant values. They weren't the values, really, of Pat Robertson. They were tolerant values. And today we're dealing with, obviously, a different situation with gay lesbian rights and a different definition of love. And I think it's very important to respect that. And if there's any child abuse, no matter where it is, divorce, no matter where it is, we should try to minimize them. Yeah. I think also, you know, it's not like there's too much love in this country and nurturing and adopting children. So we have to be careful about excessively prejudging certain outcomes from various liberation movements. The same attitude once prevailed against women who didn't get the right to vote constitutionally until right after World War I, you can imagine. And there were all kinds of predictions by men and industries about the terrible things would happen if you let women have the right to vote. So the important thing is the tolerance in holding all people to the same moral standards.
Yeah, and I've got to jump in since we're at the end of the hour. Ralph Nader, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us.
And thank you for Wisconsin Public Radio, and I hope all of you support public radio.
I hope they do, too. Ralph Nader, author of The 17 Traditions, 17traditions.com, if you want more info. I'm Joy Cardine. This is The Ideas Network.